From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We are very thankful for all of the support that you give us, both financially and with your encouragement. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, the Jewish celebration of Hanukkah continues through Monday, and Wednesday is Posadas Navideñas, the Hispanic Christian feast commemorating the journey of Mary and Joseph to Bethlehem. Oh boy, it's been a busy week of surprise and disappointment, pride and embarrassment at the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Even as GOP presidential frontrunner Donald Trump enjoyed another week of dominating news headlines and still more growth in his polling numbers with his outrageous Muslim ban proposal, the Republican leadership again tried to distance itself from his rhetoric. But in truth, when the Center for Security Policy, a leading anti-Muslim propaganda outfit headed by notorious Islamophobe Frank Gaffney and the source of the most extreme of Trump's ideas on the subject, when the CSP hosts a National Security Action Summit in Las Vegas on Monday, confirmed speakers include Ben Carson, Carly Fiorina, and Rick Santorum. As anti-Muslim sentiment continues to rise in this country, chapters of Interfaith Alliance across the country are working to reduce the harm. In Oklahoma City on Friday, activists gathered for a show of support at the Islamic Society of Greater Oklahoma Mosque. On Monday, Interfaith Alliance of New York State in Albany, New York, is hosting a talk titled Standing with Our Muslim Neighbors. Sadly, the Interfaith Alliance of Rochester, New York, had to postpone a rally of solidarity with Muslim neighbors because of safety concerns. And the position of Interfaith Alliance at the national level was made clear by the strongly worded comments of Executive Director Jack Moline featured in a front-page New York Times article. On Wednesday, Colorado Planned Parenthood shooter Robert Deere confirmed widespread belief that his deadly attack was indeed targeted at an abortion facility when, during a court hearing, he screamed, "I am a warrior for the babies," among numerous other outbursts. In Paris this week, almost 200 nations were represented at the United Nations Climate Change Conference, an issue that world leaders, both governmental and religious, are increasingly prioritizing in economic, political, and moral terms. Meanwhile, Beijing, China, was almost paralyzed by an unprecedented red alert for unsafe levels of air pollution. And at the same time, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas chaired a hearing that focused on marginalizing the science of climate change as dogma, not data. As my dear friend Walter Cronkite used to say, that's the way it is. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief.
A lot of the folks say, how could Donald Trump be leading with conservatives, with evangelicals, given his prior positions?
We worry a lot on this program about the disproportionate influence of the religious right on our politics. Corrosive as that can be on our pluralistic, secular, constitutional system of government, what happens when the fundamentalist outrage machine spins out of control? Respected journalist Sarah Posner recently speculated that Donald Trump, of all people, may be hijacking this constituency in support of his contrarian run for the White House. Her Religion Dispatch's article is headlined, "Trump Smashing Religious Right Formula to Bits." And Sarah will be back with us on this edition of State of Belief.
People who have secured their own sense of identity are looking for what that means in terms of what they share in common with other Americans. And I think we can provide that message.
As the year draws rapidly to a close, it's important to take a little time to look back at how far we've come and what lessons we can take with us as we face the challenges that are doubtless going to come into our faces in 2016. I'll take a look back with Rabbi Jack Moline as he wraps up his first year as Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance. But first,
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
It is just terrible. Public debate about national security at such a crucial time is being dominated by nothing more than a contest to see who can be the most extreme. It is equally distressing to see a minority being blindly targeted, even while the very important search for public solutions is being marginalized. While it may be worse right now, it's been bad for a long time. I've been privileged to work on this issue with deeply committed interfaith leaders who recognize the fundamental era of anti-Muslim fear-mongering and the threat it represents to followers of other faith traditions as well as to Americans of no religious faith. You can't dismantle the Constitution without injuring every one of us. On December 3rd, one of the leading justice advocacy organizations in this country, Muslim Advocates, honored Attorney General Loretta Lynch at their annual dinner. I was humbled to receive the Voice of Courage Award at that dinner and was so pleased to spend the evening with some of the selfless activists with whom I've been grateful to work so closely for many years. Of course, Muslim Advocates Executive Director Farhana Kara was there and kindly agreed to be with us on State of Belief Radio to talk about some of the incredible challenges the current public rhetoric is imposing on our Muslim neighbors. And so, Farhana, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Welton.
You know, it was so encouraging to spend the evening with you and our allies earlier this month. Those are priceless hours because once you step out the door, it can feel like all too many Americans are ready and even eager to scapegoat a religion and its followers for any number of horrors in today's world. And once again, it can feel like you're a voice in the wilderness. At least I feel that way. Do you ever feel that way these days?
I hear what you're saying, Welton. And let me first say, though, that as an American and as a Muslim, I certainly understand the fear and the anxiety and, frankly, the confusion a lot of us are feeling about these recent acts of senseless extremist violence that have taken place in our country. I think we're all seeking to have acts of extremist violence stopped and prevented. But I think what it also reminds us is that just as we had many thoughtful people after the attack on the women's health care clinic in Colorado just 2 weeks ago very quickly say, hey, we can't paint all Christians as being responsible for this gruesome act. We're calling for the same level of focus and rationale when it comes to this gruesome act in San Bernardino as well. And so I think you're really right that there is, I think, a silent majority of Americans who understand that at the core of who we are is that we don't judge people based on how they look or how they pray, and that our strength and who we are as a country, frankly, lies in our diversity, in our commitment to our shared values. And the U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch I think we were so heartened to hear her just a week ago reaffirm those values and push back against the fear-mongering and the scapegoating and to remind our fellow Americans of these fundamental values.
Has it been shocking to you to see the kind of support Donald Trump's latest extremist ideas have received from his supporters, even to the point of growing his lead in several polls?
That is certainly disturbing to see that it's not just one person, mm-hmm. but that there seems to be a certain sentiment in the country that seems to be applauding these types of views. And I might add, it's not just the anti-Muslim rhetoric, but it's also been the anti-immigrant, the mm-hmm. anti-Mexican, anti-Black, anti-people with disabilities. He's basically attacked so many different segments of our population. So that's been certainly concerning to see that. At the same time, I feel like this has really been a moment where a lot of Americans who have been on the sidelines are really being called forth to really state where they stand mm-hmm. on these issues. And so we've been so heartened that yourself, Welton, the Interfaith Alliance, the Anti-Defamation League, the Evangelical Partnership for the Common Good, and a number of faith groups and faith leaders at the national level, at the local level, have been coming out and saying this type of rhetoric, these types of, frankly, crazy and dangerous policy mm-hmm. proposals don't represent who we are as a country.
Yeah. Would you talk about the problems this kind of rhetoric adds to an already dangerous situation, actually putting all Americans, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, at greater risk from terrorism?
Yeah, it's really, really very true in two ways. This rhetoric is basically feeding the propaganda rhetoric and narrative of ISIS and the death cults that they are. Part of their argument to recruit people is that this is a war of the West against Islam, mm-hmm. against Muslims. And when we have public officials who reiterate that narrative, it's playing right in to their recruiting message. And so it's very, very dangerous from a national security perspective and from a public safety perspective. Mm-hmm. It's also sending a message to our fellow Americans that their Muslim neighbor should be feared and treated with suspicion. And we believe that there's been a direct correlation between this very inflammatory, divisive rhetoric mm-hmm. and the increase in hate crimes and acts of discrimination we've seen attacking American Muslims and those perceived to be Muslim. These hate crimes the last 3 weeks, we've been monitoring these hate crimes, and we haven't seen this level of violence directed to the community. We believe this is unprecedented, yeah. even compared to the immediate aftermath of the horrific attacks of 9/11.
You know, Farhana, I was thinking this morning of what it must be like for a Muslim family with little children who are going to school every day, who have pledged allegiance to the flag for all their school years, and how those parents are dealing with the fear that their children are going to hear someone say they don't belong here.
Yeah, absolutely. This is very personal for American Muslim fathers, mothers, and their children. We've been hearing in the last week alone a number of different experiences and the thoughts and feelings from these folks, including concerns about having their children being harassed or bullied mm-hmm. in school, as well as some mothers and their daughters having frank conversations about whether they should be continuing to wear the headscarf because mm-hmm. they fear for their public safety. They fear that if they go out in public with a headscarf, they may be attacked. And there's unfortunately reason to have these concerns about being attacked and being bullied because we have seen, unfortunately, incidents over the last 3 weeks alone of children being bullied in schools, being taunted by their classmates for being part of ISIS, and women having their hijab, their headscarves being pulled, being yanked in public and being attacked. So unfortunately, this is a very precarious time for Muslims in America. Yeah. So, and that is why I think it's all the more important that all Americans stand up and raise their voices. And I think this is a time for people to not stand on the sidelines, but to really step forward and stand up against this hate. And if I might add, Welton, it's not just faith leaders. We've seen people in the public's eye, like Green Bay quarterback Aaron Rodgers,
yes,
who called out a fan for yelling death to Muslims during a moment of silence for the victims of the Paris attacks before a game started. And he made a point of saying that it's this type of prejudicial thinking that gets us into the position we are today. And, of course, President Obama himself on Sunday evening very clearly and eloquently reaffirming our nation's values and reminding the American people that at times of fear, our freedom and our commitment to our shared values is our strongest antidote, and that's where our nation's strength lies.
Farhana, I was really grateful for an opportunity to say to the crowd of people you brought together the other evening how important it is that Muslim Advocates has a comprehensive, strong legal dimension to its work, as all civil rights organizations have to have. I'd like for you to just comment for a minute about the legal side of this and the kind of work you're doing.
One aspect of what we're doing is sometimes taking legal challenges to challenge discriminatory laws and policies. And one action in particular is we've filed a lawsuit against the New York's Police Department's discriminatory surveillance program that basically targeted law-abiding Muslims in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut by sending informants and undercover agents into mosques, Muslim-owned businesses, onto college campuses, into the Muslim student groups, to collect information on the community, not based on evidence of wrongdoing, but simply because they're Muslim. And we were so heartened this year when we got a affirming ruling from a federal appeals court allowing our case to proceed and basically disagreeing with the New York Police Department's rationale for a blanket surveillance program. And the court, I think, very eloquently stated that our nation has gone down this troubling road before, whether it's the treatment of Jewish Americans during the Red Scare, the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, and that these are episodes in our nation's history that we've later come to regret as a country. And so really repudiating and rebuking the NYPD in this particular program. Our case now goes back to the trial court, and over the next several months, we'll be engaging in vigorous discovery and preparing for trial. But that was a very heartening decision, and I think it underscores the important role of our third branch of government, the judiciary, to place an important check on some of these impulses from the executive branch or from Congress that sometimes, especially in times of national crisis, can go too far and infringe on our nation's values. And I might add, of this appeals court, it was a three-judge panel that included, it was two Democratic appointees and one Republican appointee. So bipartisan support
yes,
of this federal appeals court panel.
Farhana Kara is an attorney and activist. And since 2005, Farhana has served as executive director of Muslim Advocates. Farhana, I'm glad that you're where you are with all of the abilities you have to stand up for what's right in our nation. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today to talk about this heartbreaking but vitally important subject.
Thank you so much, Welton. And I might add that I see us as just following your amazing leadership and lead. You've been the trailblazer in building and communicating the importance of interfaith work on a number of issues in our country. And so we're really just following the wonderful path you've carved out.
Thank you, friend. Take care of yourself.
You too.
Rabbi Jack Moline has been leading Interfaith Alliance for just under a year now. In the months that he's held that position, the work of truly protecting faith and freedom in our nation has been challenging, complicated, and never-ending. I wanted to take this opportunity to sit down with Jack and look back at the year that's drawing to a close. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Welton.
Okay, what's the biggest thing you didn't see coming when you took this job nearly a year ago?
That's a very easy question, and that was the reduction in civility of political discourse. I thought we had bottomed out in the past, but I am simply astounded at the places that political candidates are willing to go.
Do you know why?
I think that there is a general fear among many Americans that the America that they think they remember, which I don't think they remember well, but the America they think they remember is disappearing. And there are people who I think shamelessly are willing to exploit that fear and suggest to people that there's a way to turn back the clock. There isn't. And we will either manage change or change will manage us. And the people who are exploiting these fears are willing to be managed by change.
So did learning that early on in the year really make you revise some of what you thought the first year of your term would be like?
Yes. Actually, I had no idea what the first year of my term would be like, but I have been involved with Interfaith Alliance for 20 years. I know that our issues remain the same, but the contours of those issues have changed significantly, in large measure because of the abuse of the term religious freedom by the religious right. And I've come to understand that if we're going to succeed in our arguments against our opponents on this question, we have to define religious freedom in a way that's commonly understood and commonly understood for the good of all Americans, not the privilege of the few.
So what do you consider to be the most important issues you've had a chance to work on in 2015?
Even a month ago, I would have said that the biggest issues that we've worked on have been civil and human rights for people of differing orientations and for people of minority religions in this country. But I have to say, Welton, and we're taping this at a very difficult time in our nation's history, the one issue that seems to cut across every ethnicity, every religion, every demographic, every zip code is guns. And the culture of violence in this country, as exemplified through the use of guns in violent crime and in mass crime, is the physical expression of the culture of violence in language that's being promoted by some folks.
Jack, I never did really like asking myself this question, much less having someone else ask me this question, but I always found that the discipline of it was healthy. Is there something in particular you wish Interfaith Alliance could have done more on if there had been more resources?
Sure. There's always something we could have done more on. I would have liked to have been more out in front on the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts that are being promoted in states across the country. You know, 20 states have their own RFRA and 12 more are considering them, and they have very little in common with each other other than the title. And I think that the project that we are undertaking for next year, the proactive project of trying to define what religious freedom means in this country and how to measure it, I think if we'd been able to do that earlier, we could have avoided some of the genuine hurt that's been done by people proclaiming they have a religious right to violate local law and the Constitution.
So what would you point to as the most satisfying achievement of these last several months?
As always, and I think you will agree with me, it's the people that I've met who are so deeply committed to human rights, civil rights, religious rights for all Americans, especially those who do so when they know it's not always in their personal interests. I had a conversation actually with a former board member yesterday. I'm not going to name him. You'll probably figure out who it is. And heard him talk about how the county clerk in a neighboring county, a very small county, has refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. And he was outraged by that. That represents a huge shift in his attitudes over the course of the years that I've known him. And he hasn't changed his religious position at all, his faith position on this. He just understands that the law of the land is the law. It needs to be followed. And that if people who disagree with the principles behind the law don't support the law has no meaning for anybody.
Is there something you would classify as the biggest disappointment?
Yes, I have to say the biggest disappointment for me is that we don't have the resources to bring our message to more people. I will say that I never considered myself much of a media star. I'm certainly no Welton Gaddy. But I have been stunned by the positive response that our social media and our public statements have received, the attention that we've gotten from national media outlets, local interfaith alliances, and just individuals. And I just wish we had more resources to push that message out there, because I'm persuaded that if you take away the whatever it is, 27% of likely voters in a particular election who are supporting a form of discrimination or bigotry, we're looking at something north of 73% of America who doesn't want to stand for this stuff.
People always have asked, why did you all pay so much attention to media? And I know how much you've been on national media this first year. And my guess is that you had your eyes open to something that I had to open my eyes to, and that was the value and the power of 30 seconds on a national media program. It is incredibly powerful. It's not only powerful for us, it's powerful for the religious right and for those who are sowing the kind of hate that we're trying to counter. We've got to get on there because there's not much progressive radio. There's not much.
Right. There's state of belief and state of belief. Media is a business, and we both know that. And the more outrageous the program, whichever end of the spectrum it's on, the more listeners it's going to get. And it makes it very difficult for those of us who present what I think is a centrist point of view. And even though a lot of people would consider us to be liberals or progressives, I think we're the mainstream of constitutional and religious thought in this country. Those of us who are pursuing that kind of an agenda are not getting the kind of attention that people who are willing to call names and scream out loud and make fun of other people are able to garner. While much of the media spends its time clucking the tongue at the outrageousness of some of the actions that we see, they're not seeking out voices to the contrary that can present a calming and uplifting and healing message to America. So when we get a message out there, whether it's by social media, which is by our own efforts, or whether it is a quotation on the front page of the New York Times or in the pages of the New Republic, or even a negative mention as we got in the Wall Street Journal, it puts people on notice that they do not have to succumb to the kind of hysteria and hyperbole that has become the stuff of commercial media.
That's well said. What kind of priorities are you thinking about in relation to 2016?
We want to invest ourselves in this proactive effort, not just to measure religious freedom, but to engage scholars, thinkers, academics, journalists from across the spectrum of the American faith community and people of no faith at all to discuss what the meaning of religious freedom is and how that ought to apply in the upcoming elections in 2016. I think this remains an enormously important issue for most Americans, and that people who have secured their own sense of identity are looking for what that means in terms of what they share in common with other Americans. And I think we can provide that message.
You know, election years, national election years in particular, create a lot of teachable moments. And I know that that's going to happen in 2016. How would you describe your program related to the election next year?
My field is religious liberty. So the first thing that we're going to do is keep an eye out and our mouths open about issues of religious freedom and religious liberty in this country, and make sure that we do not have conversations on the campaign trail to the very best of our ability that set one group of Americans against another because of their beliefs or because of whom they love or because of any of the other things that are guaranteed to us as individuals by the Constitution and create a common ground for us as Americans. That will be my major message, and I'm hoping people will be listening.
Rabbi Jack Moline is Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance. As the organization continues its work to protect faith and freedom, to defend the constitutional underpinnings of our democracy, and to challenge unconscionable attempts to subvert the fundamental idea of religious liberty, your help is needed more than ever. You'll find information about joining Interfaith Alliance and becoming a supporter at interfaithalliance.org. That's interfaithalliance.org. Jack, it's always good when you're coming to the microphone. I appreciate you doing it today, and we look forward to doing it many times more.
And Welton, at the risk of sounding like I'm going over to the other side in a war that we're reluctant to fight, Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Thank you.
Investigative journalist Sarah Posner is expert at identifying religious influences on our politics and culture. In a recent piece for Religion Dispatches magazine, headlined "Trump Smashing Religious Right Formula to Bits," Sarah writes, "It's possible to see Donald Trump as, quote, the perhaps unintended consequence of religious conservatives' quest for a politician savior." I'm very happy to have Sarah back with us today on State of Belief Radio. Sarah, welcome back.
Thank you, Welton.
You are among the journalists who have written about Ben Carson's appeal to conservative Christians. So let's add Donald Trump to the list today. Where does he come into all of this?
Well, Trump has consistently, throughout the primary campaign, maintained strong support among white evangelicals. Now, not all the polls break down likely Republican voters into religious categories, but among the polls that do, Trump has, for months, received somewhere between 20 and 30% of the white evangelical support. Mm-hmm. So you look at the field and you say, okay, so there are a number of candidates who seem like they would be the perfect fit for the religious right. Mike Huckabee, he's a former pastor. Ted Cruz, he's the son of a pastor. Scott Walker, who was forced to drop out, also the son of the pastor. All of those people know how to speak the language of the religious right. They know the Bible. They're conversant in the Bible. They're conversant in the rhetoric of the religious right. And Donald Trump is none of those things. Yet Donald Trump is getting more support among white evangelicals than those other candidates are, although that's changing a little bit with Cruz of late. And so you have to ask yourself the question, why? The religious right, for the last several campaign cycles, you know, since Ronald Reagan, has demanded of their candidates, we want to hear your salvation story. We want to hear that you believe America is a Christian nation. We want to hear that, you know, you read the Bible every day. We want to hear that you pray. All of those things. Donald Trump doesn't do any of those things, yet he's drawing those voters. Why? Because he's tapping into their fears that America has been taken over by outside forces, unspecified and sometimes specified. Mm-hmm. America must be great again. And so you've got to conclude that for the evangelicals who are supporting him, those things are more important than the religious factors.
You know, the religious right has rarely ever been about religion.
That's right. But Trump exposes that for about them.
Yeah, yeah. And we got a very small taste of it after the last election when so many of the people in the religious right just had fits because we might have a Mormon running for the presidency. But they got over that real quick once that was the Republicans' nominee. When you write about Trump smashing the religious right social issue litmus test, what about him would normally disqualify him from the religious right support?
Well, you know, he doesn't have a track record on either abortion or same-sex marriage. He's played lip service to that. Mm-hmm. He hasn't talked at all about religious freedom in the way that they would want to hear a candidate talk about it, that mm-hmm. the bakers and the caterers are having their religious freedom infringed upon by marriage equality, for example. He doesn't talk about the Bible. I mean, mm-hmm. I was there at the Values Voters Summit when he brought his Bible with him and waved it in the air, and the audience was not convinced. Mm-hmm. They have these expectations that they've laid out, and it's been a playbook that all the candidates have followed for decades. Mm-hmm. You know, talk about piety, talk about the Judeo-Christian values, to talk about the Christian nation, talk about how much you believe in the Bible, talk about how much you pray, talk about how it's important to pray. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't do any of those things, yet he's risen to the top of the pack by essentially being this messianic figure to them, prophetic figure, warning about America's decline and how he'll make America great again. But that has nothing to do with religion. And so that exposes that they really aren't about religion, mm-hmm. that they're really more about politics and nationalism.
So, Sarah, do they know what they're doing? And is there any rational explanation?
There's a rational explanation in that there are, of course, quite a number of evangelicals who are horrified by Trump, mm-hmm. right? Russell Moore, the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, comes to mind as one of Trump's most prominent evangelical critics.
Mm-hmm.
Moore is the go-to person for, you know, what do evangelicals think? That's when reporters pick up their phone and they call Russell Moore.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's been clear throughout this campaign that he doesn't really represent what all evangelicals think, because if he did, then Donald Trump wouldn't be leading among evangelical mm-hmm. polls. So I think that they've sort of lost control of the base in
mm-hmm.
a way.
Mm-hmm.
So the voices of reason can't reason with the base anymore. The base is obviously motivated by somebody like Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the leadership does with that, because they must realize now that appealing to religious virtue or religious values hasn't really spoken mm-hmm. to a significant segment of white evangelicals.
How much of this, Sarah, is a constituency that has been primed for outrage and a sense of victimization in an age of progress on issues like LGBT rights and being drawn to the guy who screams the loudest? Isn't Trump giving those people permission to do all of the fit throwing and screaming they've been wanting to do for a long time?
Well, I think it has more to do with a fear of losing what they consider to be a way of life mm-hmm. that they're losing control of.
Hmm.
So they look at, say, the Supreme Court decision in Obergefell last spring,
mm-hmm.
and everything that the religious right political apparatus and legal apparatus did to try to fight that was unsuccessful. And so now we have marriage equality.
Mm-hmm.
They look at the growing diversity of the population of the United States,
mm-hmm.
immigration. They look at what they perceive to be the, you know, infiltration of our country by Islamic jihadists. And all of this strikes at this fear that the way things that they have known them to be for their lives, that they consider to be American and Christian, is being taken away from them. And
mm-hmm.
I think that Trump speaks to that more than anything else. And mm-hmm. I think that he speaks to what his supporters see as the failures not only of the Republican Party, but of the constituencies that make up the Republican Party, including the religious right,
mm-hmm.
to achieve that cultural hegemony that they want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Recently, Trump offended some members of the Republican Jewish Coalition with a speech that was laden with stereotypes. I understand that he was scheduled to meet with Benjamin Netanyahu when he was going to be in Israel, and now his anti-Muslim comments, I suppose, have caused a delay in that meeting. Do you think Trump's ready to be an international statesman?
No. And he probably never will be. You know, all of these things disqualify him. You know, if he didn't realize some of the things that he said at the Republican Jewish Coalition were playing on long-standing anti-Semitic tropes, you know, like that, you know, mm-hmm. Jews are good negotiators and they, you know, they're good hagglers. They're good at striking a good deal. You know, if he didn't realize that that was an anti-Semitic stereotype,
mm-hmm.
then there's something wrong. If he did realize it and he didn't care, there's also something wrong. But he and his defenders said, oh, you know, he wasn't trying to be anti-Semitic. But, you know, if you think about those things before you speak to an audience like that. But, you know, to be honest, I think that that audience was more upset at his refusal to state a clear position on whether Jerusalem should be the eternal capital of Israel, which is a litmus test for that constituency. Mm-hmm. So I think as we move further into this campaign, it's not just his extremist statements and his racist statements about Mexicans or about mm-hmm. Muslims or about saying that we should ban Muslims from this country or we should send immigrants back to Mexico. It's that I think it's becoming clearer to a lot of people that I think he thought would be in his orbit that he doesn't really understand how to speak to particular audiences. Mm-hmm. And maybe that will aid his rivals, mm-hmm. but I'm not convinced that it will, because I think that there's just been so much excuse-making for him and so much fear of alienating the base that's supporting him mm-hmm. that there hasn't really been sufficient speaking out against him among conservatives and Republicans.
Sarah, is there an anti-Trump effort or movement within the religious right, or do you have any idea about that?
I don't think that you could call it a movement. There are definitely people in the religious right who are concerned or upset by Trump, even outraged by Trump, mm-hmm. but I don't think that there's any organized, as far as I know, any organized movement to stop his quest for the nomination.
What's going to happen? What's going to happen with religion, government, and Trump? What are you keeping your eye on? What are you thinking is going to come down the pike next?
Well, you know, he and the support that he gets makes me very concerned about the status of Muslims in the United States of America. And already we're seeing an outbreak of anti-Muslim hate crimes and threats. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, we all know that words have consequences. Mm-hmm. So I think that optimistically, he will force a conversation about religious freedom that we haven't had. You know, for the past mm-hmm. several years, we've had a conversation about religious freedom that centers on whether employers should have to provide birth control mm-hmm. coverage to their employees or whether, you know, a caterer has to cater a same-sex wedding. Mm-hmm. And so optimistically, he will force a conversation about actual religious freedom mm-hmm. and the role of religion in presidential discourse. Mm-hmm. Pessimistically, it's just going to get worse because I think that Trump feeds on what his audience wants. Mm-hmm. He goes on what his audience has reacted to on the campaign trail. Mm-hmm. So if they continue to react positively to his anti-Muslim screeds, I'm afraid that he's going to engage in more of them.
Gosh. Sarah Posner is an investigative journalist of the First Order who writes widely about religion and politics for The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Atlantic, The American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, and Religion Dispatches. Sarah is the author of the book God's Prophets, Profits, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. You know, Sarah, we've talked a bunch of times on this program, but I don't know whether I've ever ended a conversation with you as full of anxiety and a little bit of pessimism, though it's very disturbing. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me, Welton.
Before we go, I had to think long and hard before doing what I'm going to do right now, but encouragement from my producer and others persuaded me that you won't think me immodest for sharing with you a few of the words that I had the chance to say at the recent Muslim Advocates dinner that I talked about earlier in the show. When it comes to issues of the heart, and I'm speaking now to the Muslim community, when it comes to issues of the heart, you should not have to go it alone. It is far past time for all religions in this land, majority religions and minority religions, to position themselves alongside you as Muslims and to remain alongside you tirelessly advocating for eradicating hate and practicing injustice as you're having to experience. What Farhana and I had the honor of doing together, along with other colleagues, sitting at a table with the Attorney General of the United States, seeking wisdom that would move us through crises with no abdication of support for the Constitution, testifying in Congress to expose the lies being told about Muslims, and clarifying the difference between a religion of peace and a Sikh organization perpetrating violence, and encouraging the White House to highlight the plight as well as the benefits of all minority religions in our nation. It is work that needs to be done. No, it is work that has to be done in media, coffee houses, humanist gatherings, board tables, universities, atheist organizations, and houses of worship all across this nation. If Muslims are not free in this nation, none of us are free in this nation. And I hope that our time of celebration this evening can serve as an inspiration and a time for all of us to recommit ourselves to doing the work of freedom together for the integrity of religion and the vitality of our democracy, and please God, for the possibility of peace. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you for that gift. We rely on listener support to keep this show on the air. As the end of the year gets closer, please consider a tax-deductible contribution to State of Belief and to Interfaith Alliance. If you heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to friends or acquaintances, please share it with them. It's very easy to do on Facebook, Twitter, and at stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you'll find extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned on the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today of Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.